So as the third part of our Health and Halacha series, where we discuss different issues pertaining to health, medicine, as it relates to Halacha, I wanted to take a look at how Halachic authorities, and this is really something that's developed recently as there's been more awareness about it, how Halachic authorities have dealt with obsessive-compulsive disorder. From what I was able to find, about 1 in 40 adults are diagnosed with at least some form of OCD, so it's not something that's uncommon. And it's something that one might think is particularly susceptible to, to become more pronounced with observance of halacha. Halacha does emphasize minutia; it does emphasize attention to detail. So one question that I want to explore is OCD more widespread among religious people? And in particular, does Jewish law encourage behaviors that characterize OCD, thereby exacerbating the condition? So first we want to see what are some characteristics of OCD in general? How is it more common among religious people? And how have contemporary halakhic authorities approached OCD, and what impact has it had on their rulings? Because in recent years, it's something that is mentioned by name. There are particular, maybe about 50 years or so, within the last 50 years, the Stipler, who's Yaakov Israel Kanievsky, so he wrote a letter to someone that was definitely, you could tell the symptoms were OCD, though I didn't term it that, maybe it wasn't as recognized that was conditioned, but certainly more recently, halakhic authorities have written using the term OCD, and how, with the understanding and the pervasiveness, for that matter, of the disorder, how has it impacted their rulings? So I also want to have a disclaimer, it may not be necessary, but that I have no expertise in psychology, psychiatry. I'm not a halakhic authority, so this is not meant to draw from any practical rulings, but I thought we would just look at some of the issues that impact contemporary Jewish rulings on this. And like our other topics, I think it's important to emphasize while we're looking at some of these things from maybe a more theoretical level, these are real issues where real people are impacted in ways that are very difficult. So I think that shouldn't be lost on us. So in short, what is OCD? So what are OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. So what are obsessions and what are compulsions? So obsessions are defined as recurrent, persistent thoughts, impulses or images that are experienced as intrusive and inappropriate, causing marked anxiety or distress. They are excessive and unreasonable, not grounded in reality, and a product of one's own mind rather than someone else's conditioning. So I think the real thing with obsession is a focus, inordinate focus on certain things, and which take up a large part of someone's thought process. And compulsions are repetitive behaviors that a person feels driven to perform in response to the obsession, to resolve and quiet worries by preventing some dreaded event or situation, but that are an unrealistic or excessive response to the situation. So, of course, some common examples of OCD are, a person going back and checking that their door is locked, serious, extreme concern about germs and infection, washing their hands more than excessive. So there will be this obsession, a focus on a certain danger, and then behavior that it tries to address that obsession, and oftentimes it becomes, just a vicious cycle that you have this focus and you have this behavior that, unfortunately can lead to difficulties. And I think there are, depending on, all conditions, there are, varying severities, but there are treatment options or common approaches to treatment. They include medication, psychoanalysis. I think more popular ones are different types of, behavior therapy, cognitive therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, and a lot of those therapies really without using medication, or maybe combined with medication, but the therapies are really meant to, you know, have someone face their fears or their obsessions head on. Either they'll, you know, let's say, you know, they're very sensitive or very worried about germs. Okay, so they'll open a door and then won't wash their hands afterwards, or they'll leave their house, lock the door, and won't go back to, you know, it'll be a certain type of conditioning. But many times through this, the symptoms can be diminished. There are different ways, so there are different methods of treatment. And as noted, much of this, Rabbi Turchiner has several different series on also medical ethics, medical halacha, so many of these sources are taken from that with his permission. So if I were to pose the question, does religion, particularly does Jewish religion, Jewish law, do you think that would exacerbate OCD? There's no...
Yes.
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 No.
Meaning, I mean, I guess what the question is, someone, let's say, has whatever, internal chemical condition that would cause OCD. So let's say with that same person, so you could place that same person in an Orthodox Jewish community, or you could place them in, Kansas somewhere. So you're saying that if that same person was lived in the Orthodox Jewish community, that their condition would be exacerbated?
Oh, no. Then I changed my mind. No.
I mean, you're talking about, like, the same person.
I'm talking about, it is a similar situation. I think orthodoxy can exacerbate it.
Meaning from someone who is already prone to it, or maybe...
No. But anyway.
Right. And I think that's, and this maybe we need more like a medical, is anyone a psychologist, psychiatrist? So,
you are. No, I'm not. But I think that you can tell an OCD person regardless of the environment they're in.
Right.
So in other words, are Jewish customs or traditions going to bring out even worse reactions in the OCD person? I personally don't think so, but.
Right. So that's the question. I want to, again, not being an expert, but we have, when I sent out the email, I said obsessive compulsive behavior. And, disorder, I think, is the extent when people, behave in ways that are, beyond the norm or even for them or, are leading to anxiety. It could be, I think it's reasonable to say that there are people in general whose personality is more detail oriented and focused, and maybe even if one is working within a system like halacha that is more detail oriented, so they may be, again, have in some ways more attention to detail. It may not mean, I just want to make the distinction between someone who has clinical OCD and someone who may emphasize attention to detail.
So you also have to sort of make the distinction, because my son has what they call OCB, which is not the full-blown disorder. So he is pays lots of attention to detail, like you say, but he's not,
Right.
If you looked at him, you wouldn't know that he has it.
Right. He probably doesn't.
Things he's not doing.
Right.
Likes to fold his laundry, everything that way should be.
Right. I mean, there's certain, I don't know every condition, but there are certain people, just their personality are very, attentive to detail.
Mostly, just his thoughts, but by looking at him, you couldn't tell what he's brooding over or thinking about.
Right. So there's definitely a spectrum. So I think there's a tendency to think that it may very well exacerbate the problem because of the attention to detail. I don't know if we could say that halacha makes people OCD, but could we say that if someone has OCD, it could be exacerbated by halacha? So that's the question. Do we have one more?
Well, would that be only true for Jewish faith or any other religions?
So are they,
other religions also require very stringent laws.
Right.
So could be true for any religious person, regardless of their religion.
It could be. Right. It's not specific to Judaism. It happens to be in halacha. There's, again, a lot of attention to details, whether it's chametz, measurements. There are things that are very detail oriented. So a couple of studies that is able to find seem to conclude that there's that religion does not necessarily exacerbate OCD, meaning it can manifest itself in religious observance. I mean, it certainly does. Certainly people with OCD have obsessive-compulsive behavior when it comes to religious observance. But the question is, if it wasn't halacha, if it wasn't, you know, the amount of matzah they could eat to fulfill the mitzvah, so would it be something else? So source number one, a study about, it was help for scrupulosity in religious compulsions. So he says, a superficial view may lead an observer to conclude, as do some mental health professionals, that religion is a source of scrupulosity. However, after all, a scrupulous man obsesses about sinning if he feels attracted to a pretty woman only because he believes this constitutes committing adultery in his heart. I think this is written by a Jewish person. But this superficial view fails to distinguish between religion causing the disorder from religion as its background. It says religion does not cause scrupulosity any more than teaching someone French history causes him to believe he is Napoleon. All human beings exist in some cultural context, and I think this is key. Cultural backgrounds provide the scenery around which emotional problems create the drama. So he does note that there are some mental health professionals who do think that religion can exacerbate it, but he apparently has concluded that the symptoms will play themselves out in the cultural context. So if the idea is, you know, eating matzah or cleaning for Pesach or whatever it may be, so that OCD will manifest itself in that. But at least according to this study, it does not indicate that if it wasn't this, then it would be something else. I think that's basically what this study suggests, that it's, you know, it would be whatever it is in the cultural context that they're in. So let's say it would be halacha in Judaism. Let's say it could be, attention to grades or whatever it may be. Yeah.
Can I give you an example?
Sure.
There was a teenage boy in yeshiva who was taught that it was important to wash his hands, right? You have to wash your hands before you eat. You have to wash your hands before you learn. You have to wash your hands when you go to the washroom. He started to wash his hands so much that they got chapped. And he felt that he was doing the right thing, but his hands were chapped, so obviously he was overdoing it. It worked out that he was subsequently stopped overdoing it, and now after several years he hasn't picked up on anything else that he's doing in terms of, and in other words, he wasn't anxious about it, and he wasn't upset about it. He was just doing it because he felt it was the proper thing to do.
Right.
It took a few years.
Right. So I don't know the background of the condition, but
because you're taught that this is sort of really important, which it is, and so if you want to follow what you're told, if you're sort of a good boy,
right?
You know,
I guess then, you want to do everything to the
then
max.
You want to do everything with your full heart as you can,
right?
Not understanding the balance that there is in life.
Right.
And that would not be considered OCD, would it?
But that, right. So in other words, that's an example from before where you gave the description there that it really would, but he was really overdoing it.
Right.
And he was overdoing it seriously for quite a while, and it took real input to pull him out of it.
And it's good that this was recognized.
In that case, if I may, I don't think that one can say that religion has caused it. I think the person who's OCD
manifests
would be washing
itself.
OCB or OCD would be washing their hands regardless of whether it was for whatever reason.
So actually, it's and I'm not taking a position on this, I think, because I think there's some debate in the mental health community. But if you look at source two, he says that in the second paragraph, he points out, he says that OCD symptoms of religious nature are not found in all areas of ritual, nor necessarily in areas of ritual most hallowed by the religion. He says, in our experience, and he works more in the Orthodox community, with Jewish patients, for example, Sabbath observance is a very important feature of religious life associated with many detailed laws. right? The Sabbath is a very, it's a capital offense if one intentionally breaks the Sabbath. It's one of the stricter and most severe laws. But he says, but does not appear frequently among the religious obsessions of OCD in our clinic. In other words, he doesn't find that people come in with, I'm so worried about, I don't know, moving muktzah. Or I'm so worried.
Because it's only one day a week.
Right.
Person would be observed, have to do something every single day.
Right. So that's what he points out. It could be every day, but he notes that he says, however, cleaning the perennial region before prayer gets one line in the footnote of a latter-day code of Jewish law, but this ritual presents often impatience with OCD in our practice. He says, and you have other things, right, washing oneself, attention to cleanliness, the washing the hands example. And again, it could be that maybe, you know, as Rebbeim said, this was really important. But what he notes, and I imagine many people have come through his door, is that with the religious OCD patients, the things that they're obsessive and compulsive about are similar to things that people with OCD are obsessive and compulsive about in different contexts. It may be someone's very obsessive with cleanliness, so if we learn that cleanliness is important in preparing for prayer or in washing oneself, so then that could be the motivation. But I found it very interesting that he says you don't find, you know, as much people, you know, coming in because they're worried about some detail of Shabbos.
Well, the main point, I think, that even with the hand-washing example, is that it has to cause them anxiety and distress.
Right.
If it didn't cause that, I mean, maybe physically it was very uncomfortable, but if he wasn't distressed about or anxious, maybe the adults around him were, but he wasn't himself, so...
Right, then it probably wasn't.
Yes.
Right.
So it has
right.
to cause the person anxiety.
Right, exactly.
Right, and so it's really a diagnosis. That's why one needs...
From a medical way, you're putting a thing on it, yeah.
Right, right. And of course, you need a professional to diagnose. But
it was a problem.
It was a problem, right?
It wasn't the medical.
It wasn't
right. I mean, I don't know the case. If I wouldn't be qualified to answer. But so if you go on the second side of the page, so it's Dr. Greenberg. So he has a test. You know, what would be considered symptoms of OCD in a religious context? So he says, so compulsions transcend requirements of Jewish law. So, you know, let's say eating matzah, for example. So let's say you have to eat throughout the milkah, you have to have, you know, kazayas and olive size. Maybe that's bigger than an olive. But it's, let's say, you eat a whole box of matzah. So something that goes beyond the requirement. Or you wash your hands, you know, before you eat. And then, you know, you need to wash again. Things that are beyond what the law requires. Because the compulsions that have a narrow focus on one area of religious experience. So I'm just using the example of washing, not your particular example, but maybe, you know, the why it's washing as opposed to, you know, I don't know, making sure your head tefillin is in place. There's compulsions focus on something that is trivial to religious practice, but normal for OCD. And even with washing before, you know, washing in the morning, washing before bread, and washing before davening, there are certain times where it's mandate to wash. But, it's not, you know, generally ranked as, you know, let's say eating chametz on Pesach or violating Shabbos. But there's sometimes an inordinate focus on that. And compulsions cause the patient to ignore, be unable to fill other areas of religious law. You know, an example of this could be, you know, one is not supposed to put on tefillin, you know, if they need to, you know, pass gas or, you know, go to the washroom. So, and we'll see, there's a certain, you know, I guess, basic level of cleanliness that one has to have. But let's say there are people, and I've heard this, are so nervous that in some ways they're not as, you know, clean, even hygienically, as maybe they should be. So then what happens? Then they don't put on tefillin. So that could be a symptom. And finally, the patient repeats actions because of doubt where law would not require it. And this is a big one. They'll say with the Shema. So you're supposed to pronounce every word, and you're supposed to say the words correctly. doesn't mean you have to repeat every word of the Shema five times. So sometimes OCD will manifest itself in that, that you have a doubt. Maybe I didn't say the word correctly, so I need to say it again. Oh, maybe there was something a little bit off about that, so I need to say it again. So these are all, and you have to, you know, be diagnosed, but he says that these are all, you know, things that stand out that may be cause for concern. So the question is, does Jewish law encourage behaviors that characterize OCD? So we'll go back to some, you know, sources that are not addressing the condition, but as far as, you know, these type of attention to detail, you know, to what extent do we say, you know, it's sufficient? So one general, you know, overarching principle that's important to remember is we say derecha darcheinu v'chol nesivo se'ashalom, that his ways are pleasant, and all of our paths, as in the feminine, all his paths are of peace. So that, you know, Judaism is supposed to be, there are things that are difficult, but Judaism is supposed to be a pleasant experience. Yeah, there are some cases that aren't pleasant, that Tisha B'Av is not pleasant, you know, Avelis isn't pleasant, but for the most part, we're supposed to enjoy doing mitzvos. It's supposed to be something that, you know, is not really a cause for, you know, anxiety and sadness. So that's sort of an overarching principle. And the question of cleanliness, so when saying the Shema, so one is supposed to be, you know, hygienically clean. So how sure does one have to be that they're reached that level of cleanliness? So the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, source 4, says, Amar Papa, Tsoa Bimkoma. So if the feces is on the spot where it emerges from the body, Aser Likros Kriya Shema. So one is not allowed to recite Kriya Shema, you know, if they are, you know, unclean in that way. So hechi dami, ida niras pshita, meaning if you can see it, so for sure that your body would not be in the proper state to recite Shema. So delo niras, but what if you don't see it? You know, what if there is, I don't know, possibility? So the Gemara says, and this is a principle we find elsewhere, the Torah, the Malachei Hasharis. The Torah wasn't given to ministering angels. You know, this isn't just about it, this issue, but in general, we have certain guidelines. But if unbeknownst to us, there's something, you know, something is lacking, so we do what we can. You know, and this is something at least that it's applying here is okay. We're supposed to be clean in that sense, okay. But if there's something we don't see, it's, you know, it's not apparent that, you know, one is unclean. Okay, so you don't have, there's a limit to how much you have to ascertain that, you know, you're in the right state of cleanliness.
Doesn't say in another place that triamot should go away, triamot?
Right, so that's if you're in a place where there might be excrement. This would be really, if it's, you know, on your body, you want to make sure, and now we're, you know, have ways of, you know, hygienic technology has advanced, but the idea is one should not be, and when saying Shema, so when putting a tefillin, one needs to, you know, be clean. But again, there's a certain, it seems to say that, you know, it's something that's, you know, not visible, it's not apparent, so the Torah wasn't given to the ministering angels.
I don't think a person who's OCD would be putting on tefillin if they were worried about germs because of, it's not part of them, right? Anything that comes into.
Oh, that could be. Yeah.
They don't even shake hands, man. Like, how they say Howie Mandel, the comedian, he won't shake hands with anyone.
Really?
He's OCD.
Right. What do you think?
Well, I wasn't going to, but seeing that the top that this was brought up, I know of a Rebbe, actually, who before he went to Daven every day, he administered an enema to himself so that he knew he would be clean. Now, that was, and he acknowledged that was extreme, but
Right.
Anyways, you're talking about it.
Right,
so
right.
I'm
but
throwing,
it,
I'm
no, but it's interesting, but it seems
that... It's just
right.
It's not a topic.
Right, no, I'm not, you know, diagnosing him, but it seems to be that we do, you know, and we do what would be considered, you know, kind of normal human behavior. So another place where this comes up, and actually the ramifications of it are more serious, is when a woman goes to the mikveh. So there's not supposed to be any, what's called a chatzitza, any separation, you know, that's something that she doesn't, you know, normally wear, that people normally wouldn't wear. And if there are certain types of chatzitzos, these types of barriers, so then the immersion would be invalid, and, you know, therefore it would be a terrible transgression. You know, other things, the hair also has to go underneath. That's a function of a, you know, one of the functions of a mikvah lady. But so because there's not supposed to be any chatzitza, and we're, you know, we're concerned about that, so it's the practice that before a woman goes to the mikvah, so they, you know, clean extra thoroughly, and, you know, really make sure that they don't have those things which might make the immersion invalid. At the same time, and I've heard of this being the case, you know, with women surrounding this, at the same time, okay, there's a limit. Meaning, to what extent do you have to, you know, do you have to scrub? Also, do you have to scrub so much that your you know, skin is being, you know, harmed? You know, to what extent do you take it? So even as far back as the Ramban, as the Ramban says, so medini chatzitza. So among the laws of chatzitza says lo tov. This is source 5. Hey, osa adam machmer yoser midai. Person shouldn't be extra strict, or more strict than necessary. Machapes achar hasveka lipsol tfilasa bedavar hakal, and shouldn't look, you know, for any reason why the immersion would have been invalid. Him kain ain ledavar sol, because if you were to look, there's no end. You check every single area. It's there's going to be no end. You're always going to be concerned, and it. He says lo. Lo yaknis azam rosho bisfekos hachamuros asher einlein kates v'sof, that there's, and a person shouldn't, you know, insert his head into serious, interminable doubts, such as shein, and to which there is no end. Kigon so atzma ineha biyoser gartzas tifsoseha biyoser, whether her she closed her eyes too much or pursed her lips too much, where maybe part of it didn't get immersed. Mishara sveikos. You think if you went to the mikvah, oh, then it sounds like he's, you know, speaking to the husband. Oh, do you make sure you're, you know, nothing was touched too tightly, and, you know, shouldn't at a certain point, you know, you do what you do. Kimi yocho lahavchin beinatzma biyoser velo atzma biyoser. You know, for who could evaluate whether she closed them too much or not? That, I don't know, we assume that a woman went to the mikvah, so she did it properly. You know, that's basically what the Ramban is telling us. And you're right, this is, you know, a much more serious issue than, let's say, even saying Dishman when one is unclean. But he says, even there, you can't worry and consider every single thing. You prepare yourself according to the, you know, halachic process. But don't worry about everything, because you're never going to stop worrying, and, you know, it's going to make you crazy. In this case, it'll, you know, certainly cause shalom bias issues. And this was, I'm sure, not taking into account OCD, but just in general, there's a certain procedure, and you don't have to go above and beyond that. Where else do we see this? What time of year do people become, you know, quote unquote, crazy? Pesach, right? How do people become crazy on Pesach? Clean every crumb. What about in the attic?
Everything, your books. You know,
everything, where, books. What about places where you never find chametz?
But people still clean there.
Right. So what does the Mishnah say in Pesachim? In source 6, it says kol makom she'ein makdisin bo chametz ein sarich bedika. Any place where chametz is not brought, you don't need to check. Now, if you have, you know, young children, so that could, the places where you would be exempt from checking may be quite smaller, but in general, if someone, let's say, I don't think I could say this, and Baruch Hashem with two young children, I don't think I could even say this confidently with the bathroom, because you see like a Cheerio on the floor. It's not, nothing's impossible. But probably for most people, I don't say ever, probably most people don't need, you know, Cheerios in the bathroom. Not everybody, but probably, like, so then if you don't eat in the bathroom, so you don't need to check for chametz in the bathroom. The obligation is only to check in places where one brings chametz. This is clear from the Mishnah. And it says, the next Mishnah, it says, Ein choshishin shema garra chulda mibayis labayis umakum lamakum, and we're not concerned that a weasel may have dragged the chametz from one room to another, or from one place to another, because Adim Kain, echatzer lechatzer, me'ir le'ir, ein ladavar sof. Because then you'd always be concerned. This is, let's say you store some chametz away and you lose a piece, you don't know where that... You have to be careful actually with putting out the 10 pieces that you find each one. But you see a piece, then you don't have to be concerned about everything. It also uses this expression, ein ladavar sof. There's no end to the matter. And again, we see we have a procedure. We're not really supposed to become neurotic about Pesach. It doesn't sound like that. Also, this could be a separate share on Pesach, but as far as owning chametz, if it's not edible, it's another story there. With eating it, it's more strict, because even a small amount can be prohibited. But but even with cleaning all places that the bathroom, the ceiling, things behind the fridge. How many things behind your fridge can be? The standard is that it's fit for a dog to eat. Plenty of stuff behind your fridge that's been like. Again, the halachic sources, some of them say that it's not necessary, but if someone shows that they shows a certain enthusiasm if you do it, then I think the Beis Yosef says that we shouldn't make fun of the people who do it. Okay, so we won't make fun of the people who do it because their intentions are good, but it really doesn't mean that you have to do it, that you're supposed to check. The obligation is to check places where chametz is usually brought. So that's just one example where we see even the law in the books is not that you have to check everywhere. So just a general principle, the Shach in Source 7 outlines this. He says, Kishem she aser lahatir esa aser, kach aser laser esa mutar. Just as it's, one may not permit the prohibited, so one may not prohibit the permitted. Because generally, this will cause a leniency in some other area. And I think this principle is very true. One has to be careful about, taking on too many. I mean, again, everyone's different, but not a blanket statement. But sometimes when people are particularly, machmir, stringent in one area, you have to be careful that it doesn't come at the cost of another area.
Yep. The only thing I think these sources have a value here, but the only thing I'm a little bit, I'm not on the same page with you, if I may, is that these are all elements that a person who's not OCD is observing.
100%. And I'm getting there.
Okay.
100%. Right. This part was just, does halacha encourage behaviors that's similar to symptoms of OCD. But that's exactly the point. We'll see tshuvos more recently that make that point. Is there are certain people you tell them over and over again, let's say you don't have to look for chametz, you don't have to say the bracha again. That's the example, and the tshuva says that they won't listen, acknowledging that it's a condition. Mm-hmm. But just in general, what's the law in the books? Maybe we could say, if the law in the books is you have to scrub every last spot in your house, so someone who's who's doing that very anxiously, okay, maybe that's not a sign of anything. Maybe they're just, following on the books. But we see with the case of mikvah, and the case of cleaning oneself, and the case of Pesach, that we're only required to do a certain amount. It doesn't seem like the Torah is prescribing, excessive attention to detail. Right, that's also a good point. That right, if someone is, for example, if one is concerned about cleanliness, so they will
constantly
clean themselves, or if
and it's done to such an extent that it prevents them from
doing either their other religious obligations or what we call activities of daily living.
Right, right, exactly.
What about the person who, you know, in the span of two sentences repeats Baruch Hashem like 10 times? I mean, no, seriously, I mean, there are people who, and it's very, you can't even have a normal conversation with them because...
I can't diagnose anyone. I don't know if that's... Because the question is, you know, why are they saying that? We'll get to what if someone repeats words in brachot or in shema, things where one is not fulfilled an obligation unless they say it correctly. Baruch Hashem, maybe they're excessively, I don't know, maybe they're very thankful to Hashem. I don't know. Again, it could be. It just doesn't sound like, meaning Baruch Hashem isn't one of those things that there's an obligation to say in a particular way. But who knows?
Maybe you haven't met those people, Rabbi. I don't know.
We all met many people. So, also.
Maybe you don't realize you're saying it.
So, also, as we noted, in Mishlei it says, "Derechecha darchei noam bechol nisivo shalom," that the Torah's ways are pleasant and all our paths are of peace. So how does the Torah look on us depriving ourselves of, you know, things that are permitted? So that even though we saw in Source 7 we're not allowed to permit the prohibited and prohibit the permitted, so there are certain, you know, mechanisms that the Torah has where an individual can seemingly do that. For example, an individual could take a neder, a vow. Let's say someone could take a neder not to, all apples are forbidden for me. And then it would be, apples would be prohibited to him on a Torah level. One can then maybe, if he realizes that he was did it under mistaken assumptions, but basically our mechanisms, you can prohibit something upon yourself that the Torah permits. The other example that we're going to take a look at in a second is a Nazir, a Nazirite, someone who for a certain period doesn't drink wine doesn't go near a cemetery. So it's something that wouldn't be inherently prohibited. But, and the idea of both things is that, you know, at least for a period of time or maybe on an individual level, someone can set certain, you know, certain barriers that may be conducive for their spiritual growth. But the Gemara discusses whether... whether it's better to make a neder and fulfill it, or, you know, not make a neder and, you know, not do anything. So it's a discussion. It says at the end of the day, better to not take a neder at all than to make the neder and fulfill it. And sometimes the neder are made for, you know, positive things. That, you know, if someone says, I'm going to, you know, wake up and learn this particular part of Torah, that could be a positive thing. But, yeah, maybe it says, okay, do it, but, you know, but say Bli Neder. A lot of people also, when they say Baruch Hashem, they say Bli Neder. So there are actually times where Bli Neder has halachic ramifications. You know, for example, the example I just mentioned is someone says, I'm going to go and learn a particular portion of Torah. This may be a problem when people sign up for parts of Torah. So it says that could be a neder. And if one doesn't do that, they haven't fulfilled a neder. So let's say I'm going to learn, you know, the Mishnayos Bli Neder. So that has you know, halakhic ramifications. If, you know, sometimes in shuls where they do, you know, the second Mishaberach after someone had an aliyah, you know, for the whole family, the dog and the cat, and everyone's in the whole list. So then they'll say, give tzedakah. In some places, if I understand it's a proper practice, they'll say, Bli neder yitain tzedakah. That, yeah. Okay, because sometimes you don't remember, you know, maybe you don't even mean to. So there are certain things where Bli neder has its place. Some people also, with Baruch Hashem, they say Bli neder a lot. So what does this have to do with anything? So with the Nazir, so a Nazir taking on a period of Naziris could be is considered, at least in theory, a positive thing. Someone who's been exposed to something immodest, and it could be a way for the individual to grow. But why does a Nazir have to bring a chatas, a seemingly sin offering? So the Gemara says in Source 9, he says, "So elik shetzir atzmo min hayayin," that he pained himself by withdrawing from wine. Wine is permitted. One shouldn't be excessively drink wine. But the Nazir, even though he may have taken on this period of Naziris as a way of self-improvement, he still says at the end of the day, you have to bring a chatas. There's something that's not ideal about depriving oneself of something that the Torah permits. So this is more, some of the philosophy behind, to what extent we're supposed to not go too far with Jewish law, in the classical sources. So turn over to source 9. Also just some principles which then the Posim actually mentioned when dealing with these questions of behavior that's symptomatic of OCD. So he's saying, in Tehillim it says, we have two places in Tehillim. One says, Idu es Hashem b'yira v'gilu v'irada, that on one hand, you should serve Hashem with awe. It says, and rejoice in trembling. So even that, it's supposed to be not something that's depressing, but it's something, there's a important concept, an obligation of Yiras Hashem. It's supposed to have a certain amount of a fear, or awe might be a better translation. But it says even rejoicing in this awe, it doesn't mean that someone has to be upset. And also we have Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha b'holofana b'irnana, that serve God with joy and come before Him in song. So this suggests, and others interpret it this way, that Judaism is supposed to be a positive experience. And you have Tisha B'Av, you have some days that aren't. But in general, there's this idea of a simcha shel mitzvah. This week's Parsha, they say that the tochaga, the curses came about because we didn't, serve Hashem with apparent simcha. That could be a discussion, but the idea is we're supposed to serve Hashem with simcha. And if our mitzvah observance, and this is what we're going to get into more addressing OCD, if our mitzvah observance is not only not enabling simcha, but taking away from it, so then, that's a red flag. So in source 10, Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, the stipler, so he's in the mid-20th century, so he's speaking about someone who, would repeat Shema multiple times, would repeat the Brachot multiple times, concerned that he didn't pronounce the words correctly, didn't pronounce the name of Hashem correctly. And it can become tricky because, for example, there's the halacha is if certain days of the year, if you have to insert, let's say, Yalla V'Yavo in Shemona Esrei, not at Marvin Rosh Chodesh, but other times, so one would have to, if one forgets it, they have to repeat Shemona Esrei. If you don't say Mashiva Rochem Rida Geshem, when you also don't say Marita Tal, during certain times of the year, you also have to repeat Shemona Esrei. Then other things, after 30 days, you can assume you said it, a whole thing of that. But let's say you're in doubt about whether you said a certain part of davening, where the halacha is when one is in doubt, so they would repeat it. For example, when you start saying Mashiva Ruach Marida Geshem, if you say Marida Tal, you're kind of covered the whole year. But let's say after Pesach, so you don't say so you're supposed to start saying Mashiva Ruach Marida Geshem, but if you're not sure, so we assume until 30 days you said what you said before, because we assume you said what you were accustomed to say. Okay, so in that case, I'm not sure whether I said it. The halacha says I'm not sure whether I said it, so I repeat it. So I was speaking to a Rav once, and he was saying, yeah, that's the halacha, but someone comes to you, asks you one time, yeah, you repeat it, that's what the halacha is. Two times, okay, fine. Three times, four times, five times, six times. The thing is, the halacha is, if you're in doubt, you repeat it, but then, it should, a red flag may go off, is that, are they overly worried about this? But it gets tricky, because that is a case where if there's a doubt, you would repeat it. But that's, but at a certain point, even the poskim have acknowledged that you have to, that if there are certain red flags, so you have to reevaluate.
Some people that have this tendency would repeat Shemona Esrei because they didn't concentrate enough.
Right, that's also a thing. The rule is actually for the first bracha, if you didn't concentrate, then you should repeat it. And we say you actually probably won't concentrate the second time. But right, so there are cases where if someone you know, does a mitzvah in a way that doesn't fulfill the obligation, so the directive is to repeat it. The question is, how worried are you, and how many times can you be concerned that you didn't fulfill the obligation?
A bracha is not allowed to be repeated, like a bracha over food.
So it will, you know, may be repeated if you think that you said it, if you didn't pronounce it correctly. And this is the case of Asher Weiss, we'll see he gets to.
You're not supposed to repeat it.
That's if you said it. But let's say
you're not sure if you said it.
That's a, right. If you're not sure if you said a bracha, so then you wouldn't repeat it. But I think if you're not sure whether you, meaning let's say you thought you knew that you mispronounced the bracha, that you mispronounced Hashem's name. So in that state of mind, it's like you're not repeating it. You just need to, you just think you didn't do it right. So you're trying, you're, let's say, attempting it over and over again, at least in your mind. So in a case like this, so the stipler said, source 10, and he didn't use the term OCD, but it sounds like clear that he was responding to someone who showed symptoms of OCD, and he was known to be a you know, astute person, and he was giving advice that seems to be, you know, sound advice for people who have OCD. So he said it's forbidden to give him reasons or explanations for every reason that he is given. This is as Stephen was saying, he will undermine it to contradict and reject completely whatever he was told. Right, we say, oh, you don't have to repeat it. You don't have to wash again. You don't have to eat more matzah. But he'll say, no, but I have to. Meaning, you could tell him from now until tomorrow, he's not going to listen to it. And he says, such thinking is a tactic of the Yetzer Hara in order to make observance of the mitzvah so burdensome that he will eventually, God forbid, shirk the yoke of Torah. But as someone, that's what's going to result in not only continuing harmful behavior, but if Judaism is supposed to serve Hashem with joy, and we're, you know, Judaism is becoming a sad experience that, you know, that makes us unhappy. So he says this is the Yitzhar. The Yitzhar wants to say that, oh, you know, do it again. You didn't say the Shema right. You know, trying to make it seem like he's striving for piety. But he apparently understood that in some cases you can tell someone from today until tomorrow, and even though intellectually they may know you're right, so because they are obsessive and compulsive, so they, you know, will continue the behavior unless there's intervention. And in source 11, this is in the article Rabbinic Responses to Religious Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, so he says that person, whenever he performs the will of the Creator, finds his soul and his energies contorted by feelings of discomfort, fear, tension, and misery over the carrying out of the commandment, and on the contrary, this is his usual state, and to carry out commandments out of joy is the exception. This is clear proof that this was not God's intention. Right? God didn't intend that when we, you know, say the Shema, it should be like so, in a bad way, anxious and unhappy. Or let's say take the lulav, more, oh, is this coat, you know, whatever it may be. Sukkah is man tzimchasenu. So okay, you want to make sure your lulav is kosher. But again, if when someone goes to perform a mitzvah, it's something that provokes anxiety. So he says this is a problem. This isn't the way that Judaism is supposed to be practiced. And in source 12, so now we get to. It's probably the most famous tshuva responsa dealing with OCD from Rav Asher Weiss. He was in Toronto a little while back. He is a big posek in Eretz Yisrael, and he's written many tshuvas. And he has at least two that I know of, tshuvas specifically dealing with OCD. Like in the Hebrew, it has whatever the Hebrew is, and then in letters, OCD. So it's clear that that's what he's talking about. So the case that he was dealing with is someone who, when they would say the bracha or say the Shema, so they would, you know, try to, you know, slowly say every word, but in a manner that was, you know, showed that they were so anxious about whether they would say it correctly. So it says he would spend a lot of time, you know, he's unable to. He's worried that he's not going to be able to, you know, say the bracha correctly, and spends a lot of time trying to say God's name properly, and he experiences a lot of anguish over this. This is in source 12. And so So gaze is at someone, he says Shema, he says Brachos, and he's very nervous. He spent a lot of time trying to say Hashem's name. So in this cognitive behavioral therapy that the doctors are recommended, so they say the proper course of action in this case is not to do it, or to, you know, just say whatever they say and don't worry about. So the question is, you know, let's say in this situation, if he follows the doctor's directive, so he's not going to be, he says, Baruch Atah Hashem, he's not going to be able to say Hashem's name properly, for whatever reason, maybe out of his anxiety. Or with Shema, he's not going to be able to pronounce the words correctly, because he's maybe so nervous. So the doctors say, don't try. So what if we know he's not going to be able to if he follows the doctor's orders? So let's read in English. The doctors who are experts in this field believe that the way to treat it is that he never repeat any statement or prayer. So that's, he's not sure if he said Yalav Yavo, the doctors say don't repeat it. He says, when it's clear as the sun to him that he's not said the name properly and he has not fulfilled his duty or in his bracha, so may he eat. Let's say it's clear. He's not just worrying about it. He's so nervous he doesn't say the name of Hashem correctly when making a bracha. So can he eat? You're normally not allowed to eat without a bracha. So Rav Asher Weiss answers, even if we would say that one may not violate a prohibition for medical purposes, our case is different, for he would not be healed and freed from his crisis. If he would not be healed and freed from his crisis, he would violate these mitzvot forever. In any case, because we say better to desecrate one Shabbat and not desecrate many Shabbatot, right? That's what the Gemara brings to allow breaking Shabbos to save a life. We save one life so that a person can keep many Shabbosos. So it's the same thing here. If it appears in our case too that this precious person may cancel blessings and Shema to be healed so that he will be able to fulfill these mitzvahs properly. So in the short term, it may be that one, you know, would end up eating without making a halakhically valid bracha, or one may not fulfill the Torah commandment of saying Shema twice a day. But it says, if the doctors believe, and with basis, that that this person not repeating anything or not just saying, let's say, just saying Shema and not worrying about whether the words are said completely accurately, if that is a way, if that is a therapy that will help, so Rav Asher Weiss says that, okay, for the time being, do what the doctors say. Because if not, then this person's going to be suffering forever. So it's like breaking one Shabbos, even though you're not allowed to eat without a bracha. Okay, so you do this, you would violate this now, so that the person can undergo treatment, hopefully in the future, be able to resume practicing normally.
Isn't this the principle of pikuach nefesh, though, in this case? I mean, it doesn't state so, obviously, but it seems like that's what the rabbi is suggesting.
So certainly he does entertain the idea that there are certain manifestations could be pikuach nefesh. And I'm not a professional. It could be that he is, that some manifestations of OCD are reasonably not assumed to be life-threatening. Some are. And there are even things in halacha that even if it's not imminent, if there's some sort of doubt about it being life-threatening, so that could be part of the calculation. But I think he's saying even in a case where there's not any indication that there's a threat to life, even indirectly, but even still, so he invokes this principle that one can violate Shabbos, as the analogy, one Shabbos in order to be able to keep many Shabbosos. So it's like you can, let's say, violate one prohibition, let's say eating without a bracha, in order that he can undergo the treatment and follow the doctor's regimen, and hopefully then be able to resume practicing in a way that is quote unquote normal. So there are other cases too of this next article 13 speaks about also a case in Nida with doing examinations, and Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky in source 14 says, as we noted, an OCD sufferer may not necessarily be reassured by the opinion of the poskim. Said one woman with OCD threw out three sets of dishes because she could not accept the Rav's ruling that the dishes were perfectly kosher, saying the Rav did not understand my Shaila. Mm-hmm. Right? The Rav says it's kosher. And I'm sure, he's speaking about we're laughing, but I'm sure he's speaking about a real case. I think I traced up my kitchen. Okay, the rabbi said clearly it's not. No, you could tell them from today until tomorrow. But you see that one of the ways that OCD manifests itself is people are not amenable to reason. And so one way of treating OCD, one type of therapy in source 15 says, ultimately patients need to be willing to engage in the exposure and accept the uncertainty about whether it's permissible. The notion of accepting uncertainty and acting despite the anxiety is a guideline not only for a given exposure, but also for how OCD patients must live in general. So, okay, there's always going to be a doubt whether you said Yalavio. There's always going to be a doubt about something. Okay, you live with, I mean, you have to he's saying that the goal is to be able to live with the reality that, just like we saw with the Ramban, with the mikvah, or with the laws of searching for chametz, you're never going to know everything. There's always a possibility. But we say, ein l'davar sof, if we worry about everything. And that's something through the therapy that that helps people with OCD kind of confront their obsessions or focuses and understand, you know, we have to come to the understanding that you're never going to know anything 100%, but we follow halacha and we do what we can. And source 16 says that understanding that OCD is not caused by religious adherence, but rather that such adherence can influence how OCD manifests itself in religious patients, i.e. in religious obsessions and compulsions, enables the clinician to use the patient's religious beliefs as a framework to treat the disorder more effectively. Recruiting rather than combating patient religiosity in service of treatment supports the patient in reclaiming religion as an aspect of their life that brings meaning and comfort rather than distress. So he's saying that the therapist or psychiatrist or psychologist shouldn't have the approach that, oh, it's religion causing this. So, you know, give up the religion if you didn't have to worry about chametz on Pesach, so you wouldn't have to worry about this at all. It says, no, an aware therapist or whatever variety should understand this is the, you know, cultural religious milieu that this person comes from and work within that to confront their concerns and hopefully treat the OCD or whatever other anxiety there is and serve Hashem with simcha the way we're supposed.